When I was about 10 years old, I had to call my mom this morning to get the story straight. My family and I went to Red Robin after church to have lunch. And while we were there, my parents started talking amongst themselves. You know, isn't that? Yeah, I think it is. And then they said, Ian, that person over there is Steve Largent. And you should go over there and ask him for his autograph. It's like, who is Steve Largent? I didn't know anything at the time. I hadn't yet seen the light and become a Seahawks fan. I didn't know, of course, that he was one of the greatest wide receivers in NFL history. I didn't know he'd go on to become a congressman, a very important sort of guy. Now, somewhere, actually, I have that autograph that he wrote. We walked over to him, and my parents said, because I wasn't about to talk to him, this is our son Ian, and he would like your autograph. And so anyway, this isn't that note, but actually this is Steve Largent's signature here. My folks have gotten to know him better, actually, as the years have gone by, totally outside of that situation. So here is Steve Largent's autograph, if anyone wants to see it. But anyway, he said, sure, he laughed, and he said, I'd be happy to give Ian my autograph, and you know, he wrote down my name, and then he signed his name, and he handed it back to my mom. And my mom said, what, no Bible verse? And so he took it back, and he wrote a Bible verse on it, and he gave it back to us. So I was trying to find it, because I thought, what Bible verse did he put? I can't remember. But Steve Largent, if you didn't know, is also a believer. Also a Christian. And I mentioned my parents have met him at a number of other things. He's been involved in some of the same charitable work my folks have been involved in. And my mom told him that story once. She reminded me of that this morning. She said, you know, my son and I, and we met you at Red Robin a bunch of years ago, and we you gave us an autograph. He said, was I nice? And she said, yes, you were very nice. So. But there were a lot of different ways that story could have gone, right? Why was it that my parents said, our son Ian would like your autograph this morning? It's because it's a lot harder to say no to a 10-year-old than it is to a mid to late 30-year-old. Actually, they probably were around 40 at the time. It's a lot harder to say no to a kid than it is an adult. They also went over and they didn't demand anything. They didn't say, you know, hey, you're famous. Give us what we want. Because that's a terrible way to get the sort of thing that you want. See, when we have relationships with other people or when we're getting to know other people, there are certain sorts of niceties that we follow, aren't there? We don't just go up and do whatever we want or say whatever we want, no matter what we may think. We recognize that if we want to start things off on the right foot, we have to approach this person in the right way. It's interesting. I think in the 21st century, we recognize that that's generally true, although we've become a much more casual culture altogether. I know, this is not the list of old people's gripes about the world today, but people don't usually get introduced as Mr. and Mrs. anymore, do they? We don't often say sir or ma'am. It's a more casual culture. And I'm not criticizing or critiquing it this morning, but even in our culture, we still know you don't just go up in any old way. You got to go up in the right way, one way or another. So why do we treat God so casually? Why do we treat God so casually? Don't we kind of expect that, you know, God should just be happy that we talk to him at all? Isn't there this sense of, well, God, I prayed, you know, why didn't you answer? God, I came, you know, and you didn't show up in all the ways that I thought or expected that you should. There's sort of a belief, I think, culturally, that God's there to serve us and not the other way around. God is the guy out there for me to approach when and how I feel like it. Maybe that's actually the more convicting part of it. God's out there for me to approach when I feel like it. I want God when I want God, and I don't want him the rest of the time. Stay out of my life in these different sorts of places. Don't approach me when I'm here. Don't approach me at this time. Don't approach me when I'm not ready. Don't say to me the things I don't want to hear. Just keep telling me the things I do want to hear. And of course, the amazing thing about all of this is sort of the arrogance we bring to that, isn't it? God, you may be God, but really I'm God. I'm going to be God of this relationship. I'm going to decide how to come, when to come, what you get to say. And if I don't like it, well, that's too bad, God. That's the opposite of who and what God is if he's really out there, isn't it? If God's really out there, he gets to set the terms of our relationship. Why? Because he's God. That's similar to the fact that parents have expectations for their children, don't they? We experience this in our own life. There are certain people, by virtue of the role that they play in our life or the position that they hold or whatever it is, they get to set the terms of our relationship. Even if we might have some sort of say, they set the terms. And that's not wrong. That's not bad. It wouldn't be a great world if kids didn't have to ever listen to their parents. Because a lot of the time, parents parent out of their own mistakes, don't they? You ever have that moment as a parent? You say to your kid, don't do that. Nothing good is going to come if you do it. What do you know anyway? Well, I did that. I can tell you from experience, it didn't work out. Don't we know that as children? We go to our parents and they say, don't do that. We say, who are you to tell me not to do that? You don't know. And they say, well, actually, I do. I've been there before. And I'm not listening to you. And then we go on to it. Oh, gosh. The worst thing possible has happened. My parents were right. And it's true in all of our relationships, all of our friendships. Certain people earn the right to speak into our lives in ways that we didn't always ask them to do. Why not God? And as we take a look at the opening verses of the Gospel of John here, as we look at the prologue, John wants us to know something about who Jesus is. He's telling us, as you go through the rest, as you read the stories about what he did and what he said, if you know these things about him right off the bat, you're going to understand better what he did and said. He started by telling us in the first place that Jesus Christ is the light of the world because he is the one who has made light dawn in our world. It was through him that the whole world came into being. He is our creator, and now the one who made life has brought new life for us. And then he continues. And he tells us not everyone's going to recognize this. Some people will say yes, and some people will say no. You need to understand that doesn't change who Jesus is. Our perception of Jesus doesn't change who he actually is. And finally, he tells us Jesus is the way through which we come to God himself. Jesus is the way through which we come to the Father. Jesus is going to say exactly that in several different places in the Gospel of John. People are going to say things to him like, Lord, just show us the Father and we'll be happy. And Jesus will say, don't you know who I am? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Jesus is going to give us a new way to approach God. And it's a very surprising way. First, John the Baptist, we come back to his testimony. The Apostle John keeps telling us all about John the Baptist. And in part, he's telling us about him because John had so much credibility with the audience that he was about to speak to in his gospel. It's sort of like Billy Graham coming to say something about God. Well, if anybody knows something about God, it's probably Billy Graham. If anybody knows something about God, you know, maybe it's the Pope or somebody else. People who everyone that John was speaking to would say, if anyone knows, they do. So he comes back to John the Baptist, who if anybody knows, he does. But he comes back to John the Baptist for another reason as well. Because John stands between everything that's happened in the Old Testament, everything that's happened up until his day, and everything that's about to happen in Jesus Christ. Sometimes you'll hear people talk about the time between the Old and New Testaments as the intertestamental period. The old is wrapping up. The new is about to begin. There's about 400 years between what the last events recorded in the Old Testament and what happens when Jesus comes into the world. Sometimes they're called the 400 years of silence because the prophets had stopped speaking. And John belonged to both the old way and the new. The old way because the new wasn't here yet, but the new because he was announcing something is about to happen and it's going to change everything. And so John testified concerning Jesus, crying out, saying, "This is the one," when he saw Jesus. "This is the one I spoke about when I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me.'" There are a lot of prepositions in that phrase, so let me try and unpack them. "He who comes after me." So John's saying someone's about to appear. Someone's about to appear. "He who comes after me has surpassed me. He is greater than I am." Why? Because even though he seems to come second, he actually came first. John's been repeatedly saying this throughout these first 18 verses. In the beginning was what? The Word. And the Word was with God, and he was God. He was with God when? In the beginning. In the first 2 verses, he's already said it twice. Everything came from him. He was the true light, the source of everything that's in the world. But then we continue. John reminds us of John's testimony. I wish they had different names for my preaching purposes. And then John, the gospel writer, says this: "For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." Oh, excuse me, I skipped a verse. "Out of his fullness, we have all received grace in place of grace already given. For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth through Jesus Christ." He tells us the same thing twice, essentially. "Out of his fullness, we have all received grace in place of grace already given." John was saying there was an old covenant. There is an old way of going to meet with God. Primarily, he's speaking here of the Mosaic covenant. Now, there's no point in the Bible when God says, "Here is the Mosaic covenant." Instead, there are 5 books that talk all about it. And then there are a bunch of other books that are basically commentary on the Mosaic covenant. But essentially, the Mosaic covenant was the law. Now, when we say law, we need to understand that that word is actually translating a Hebrew word, Torah. You ever heard that word before? The Torah is sort of all of God's counsel given to us in the Old Testament in one way or another. But that word Torah means, it does mean law, but more importantly, it means wisdom. It means wisdom. When we hear law, we tend to think in terms of the Western legal codes, right? Here is right, here is wrong, do it and you'll be fine, break it and you go to jail. But that's not primarily what God gave his law for. His law was wisdom given to his people for the right way to live in covenant relationship with him. A good friend of mine once told me something, and it continues to haunt me to this day, that I didn't respond in the way I wish I had. He said, "I'm not a Christian anymore, Ian. I couldn't believe in it anymore." And you know, it's because it says stuff like you should only plant one crop in your field and not two. And you shouldn't make clothing out of 2 different types of cloth, just one. Yeah, those are silly laws, and I can't believe in someone who gives laws like that. I wish I had said a number of things. The first was, way to major on the majors there. The fundamental tenets of the Christian faith are not how many types of cloth you should make your clothing out of. But the second thing I wish I had said is, see, you're showing that you don't actually know what God's law was for in the first place. You're telling me you're not a Christian anymore, but I don't think you ever grasped what your faith was in the first place. See, when those kinds of laws appear in the Bible, it's not a legal code saying this is what's right and what's wrong. Rather, it's wisdom for how a certain people were to live as God's people until he came to them. So what was the significance of only planting one kind of crop, since I brought it up, of only making clothes out of one kind of material? Well, it's primarily the fact that it reminds the people of Israel that you are one kind of people, and you're not supposed to mix. You're supposed to belong to me and just me. You're not supposed to be made up of many things. You're supposed to be made up of your identity, and that you are the one people called out of all of the world to be mine, so that all the truth about me will flow out of you to them. It's to remind you that you are unique and there's nobody like you. The problem was that by the time Jesus had come along, frankly, I don't know that Israel ever really understood God's Torah. And I don't say that to lift us up over them and say, well, we do. We're pretty great, because we get it wrong too, don't we? But if you read, we preached through last year the book of Judges, and reading that, it becomes pretty clear that God had given this amazing revelation to his people, told them all about himself, and the people never really understood, and they never really got it. They had to live by faith, just like we do, because we don't always understand, do we? When it comes to God talking about the kind of sexual ethic he wants us to have, does anyone feel comfortable talking about that with the rest of our culture these days? I'm not asking if you do. I'm asking if you feel comfortable with it. It's not comfortable. I was comparing notes with another pastor recently. You're talking about people that we had married. And he said, I was wondering if you would do the premarital counseling for this couple for reasons. And I do need you to know right off the bat that they are living together. I don't know if that impacts your decision. And I said, you know, every couple I've married has been living together. Every couple. It's not comfortable talking about God's sexual ethic because it is so weird in 21st century America. But just because it's weird, number one, doesn't make it wrong, and number two, doesn't make it God's wisdom for his people. What's marriage about? Does anyone know? It's a hard question. It is. Sometimes marriage is about just holding it together, isn't it? But Paul tells us something in the book of Ephesians. He says, he gives these household codes, because that's what everyone did in his day, and he was doing it as well, so that people would understand that Christians cared about how people lived in their homes. But then, when it came to talking about marriage, he gave some surprising advice, not advice, some surprising commands, and then he summarized them in this way. He said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. That's old news, right? That's Genesis sort of stuff. But then Paul says, this is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ in the church. See, we thought Paul was talking about marriage, but really he was talking about God and his people. And he said marriage was meant to point to the love that God has for his people and the love his people have for God. And that's why it's exclusive. And that's why it's this certain way, a man and a woman. And that's why it's not meant to be lived at or pretended to until you've actually made those promises and entered into that covenant, because God as well makes a covenant with his people. And that's what our marriages were ultimately meant to point to. And there's something that's empowering and freeing about that when it comes to marriage, because it reminds us that the purpose of my marriage is not primarily to make me happy. Is that depressing to anyone this morning? It's okay if it is. The primary purpose for my marriage is not to make me happy, but to testify to whom God is and how he loves his church. And that's why when God gives husbands instructions, when through Paul here in the book of Ephesians, he tells them, your job, husbands, they would have expected something like keep your wives in line, make sure your family grows up to be good people, that kind of thing. He says, your job, husbands, is to love your wives the way Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Your wives are not for you, they are for Jesus Christ. You love them like that. So now that I am thoroughly a hypocrite this morning, I'm not there yet. that we're meant to live up to these things. Our lives are about more than just us. And when it comes to approaching God, we're reminded that we don't just do it casually. We don't do it easily. Because all of this wisdom and law that he's given to us, part of the purpose and the point of it was to remind us, you are not a law keeper. You are not a law keeper. Now, we might do a pretty good job at keeping some of the laws, or even most of the laws, but nobody keeps all of the laws. This is a tautology. We're all lawbreakers. The Apostle Paul in the book of Romans spends a lot of time talking about what that means. He says, we're all lawbreakers. If you break any part of the law, the whole thing is broken. All of it. It doesn't matter. You're a lawbreaker. And all the punishments that come to those who break the law are applicable to you. Paul puts it, again, pretty grimly in Romans chapter 3. He says, there is no one righteous, not even one, and there is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away, and they have together become worthless. We've all approached God in the wrong way. And if we found him at all, we haven't found him as a pleasing, comforting, easy to get along with sort of person. Instead, we found all of our flaws reflected back to us. And that's grace. Did you know it? That's grace. Because when you go to the doctor, he doesn't do you any favor if he lies to you when you have cancer. He's got to tell you what the disease is so you can get the treatment that you need. That's grace. And that's why when John talks about this old covenant, he says that we have received grace in place of grace already given. The law was grace to us in that it told us who we are and how we needed God and how we could approach him until he took care of the rest. It taught Israel how to worship. Here are the festivals that you'll observe. Here are the ways that you will come to worship. Here are the things that will keep you outside the tent of meeting so that you won't find condemnation from God when you do. The old way was grace, but now something new has come in Jesus Christ. Out of his fullness, we have all received grace in place, replacing the grace that has already been given. Replacing it not so that we throw away the law and say, woo, we don't need any laws anymore. But replacing it in that is no longer the primary way we approach God. It's still God's good wisdom for living. But it's not the way we have right relationship with him. Grace in place of grace already given. Grace and truth have come through Jesus Christ. We are about to meet the man in the pages of John's gospel who will become the way in which we can approach God without fear, without condemnation, with every hope that we are fully accepted and loved, not because we have obeyed the law, but because Jesus Christ has. And because God puts us in him through faith. And that's why when we get to Romans 8, see, Paul doesn't just go, we're all dirty sinners, that's the end of the message. Sometimes I think that's how we do it, isn't it? That's certainly how Christians are known a lot of the time. Christians are the ones who say what not to do. But I'd rather be known by what we are for. We are for the God who gives life. Yesterday was Jack Rookstuhl's memorial, and it was awesome. Hearing about Jack's life, amazing. And I said to somebody, I think it was Marilyn, the pastor at the Three Rivers Presbyterian Church, as we left, I said, you know, being a pastor is a pretty awesome thing because these are difficult moments and they hurt a lot. And I don't want to minimize that in any way, shape, or form. But as pastors, our job is always to come back to the hope. And every time we have a funeral or memorial, I'm reminded of hope. That there is a God who delivers from death, a God who conquers death. I was joking yesterday in my message that I know three poems, and one of them is John Donne's Death Be Not Proud. and I use it almost every memorial I do because it's just the best. I don't have it memorized, and I don't have it in front of me, so I can't give you all of the good stuff. But I love that poem. I encourage you to read it. You can even just Google it and read it, because it tells us the truth about death. It is a broken and defeated enemy. It is gently and intelligently and wittily mocked all throughout the poem. Death, you dwell with poison and sickness and war. Your life must be miserable. And then at the end it says, death, thou shalt die. That's who we are. That's what we're for. There's a man who was born, who lived, who did things, who said things, but the most important thing of all, when he died, he didn't stay dead. He lives again. He has defeated the power of death, and he has made a way through it for you and I. That's what we're about. So go and be people, if we oppose anything, who oppose death. Who oppose the death that comes from sin, yes, but who oppose the death that comes from starvation, and that oppose the death that comes from depression, who oppose the death that comes from bullying, who oppose the death that comes from pride that leads to war and anger. Be people who are above that because of who Jesus Christ is and what he has done for us. And that's why when John tells us that we have received from Jesus Christ grace in place of the grace already given, he says that's a good thing. Because the truth is, no one has ever seen God but the only Son, the only one who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father. He has made him known. How do we approach God? John asks us and gives us the answer: through Jesus Christ, through faith in Jesus Christ, through a life that reflects faith in Jesus Christ, not because we're trying to earn points with God, but because we aren't people who belong to death anymore, but people who belong to life.